and welcome to another episode of Entrepreneurship.au. Today, we're honoured to have Usman Iftikhar, a systems engineer who is driving change in multiple sectors across different countries. He's not just a polymath who enjoys art, history, technology, music. Usman is on a mission to solve two critical global issues, climate change and the refugee crisis. His body of work has garnered him several prestigious awards, making him a notable figure in the international arena. Usman is the embodiment of the Renaissance man for the modern age. His depth of curiosity isn't just for show. It's an integral part of his holistic approach to solving intricate problems. The recognition he has achieved is nothing short of remarkable. 2018 Commonwealth Young Person of the Year, a crowning glory as it places him in notable figures amongst 1.4 billion young people in 53 Commonwealth countries. Obama leader for the Asia Pacific, signifying his influence beyond his own country, and the Western Sydney Champion 2021 Award, a testament to his impact on a local level. These accolades serve as tangible milestones in his journey to foster significant change. Usman is also the driving force behind Catalyzer, an initiative that has swept numerous awards, including the Governor General Australia Gold Medal. Think of Catalyzer as a high-potency fertilizer enabling new enterprises to sprout and flourish, especially those with social impact. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Usman Iftikhar. Thank you for taking the time, Usman. Introduce yourself to the audience and maybe a little bit about your background and what you do.
Yeah, so really a pleasure to be here. I'm Usman Iftikhar. I wear a few different hats. My main hat is Catalyzer, which is an incubator for migrant and refugee entrepreneurs that I've been running for the last 7 years. And the reason why I'm doing that is because of my own personal migrant journey of coming to Australia and, you know, seeing this opportunity, both for me to start a business and kind of supporting other migrants, refugees, often dealing with unemployment and underemployment. So if you go take an Uber today or, you know, go to a 7-Eleven, you'll find so many migrants who are kind of skilled. You know, they could be engineers, they could be doctors, but they're kind of, you know, boxing shelves or things like that. So really, I was one of those people when I came here about 10 years ago and decided that I wanted something different for myself. And I saw that that's an opportunity that I can also, I guess, extend to other people too. So Catalyzer was just an idea, you know, about 7 years ago, just to help people from migrant backgrounds start their own business as an alternative pathway into employment. And that's how I got started into this. So that's one thing that I do and that I've been involved in. So startup ecosystem, social enterprise ecosystem in lots of different ways. Have recently become an investor as well with a new fund that is investing in early stage ventures from immigrant entrepreneurs. And just doing consulting work, supporting government, local government, as well as sort of universities who also are working with diversity. So pretty much along, I guess, in this area. And my other interests are in clean tech and space tech. So things that, you know, actually very different.
You don't have kids, Sue.
I don't have kids. But one of the reasons why I'm working in kind of those areas is because I come from an engineering background. So I've had a kind of clean tech background myself. And then space is just so cool and interesting. So I just got involved in it through many different ways, but very happy to chat about all of that.
Okay. Well, let's just carve up the I guess the migrants and, you know, starting up their own businesses. I guess they're not all going to be you know, novel solutions to known problems. Sometimes they are just retail stores. I know my journey has been, you know, certainly I've sat in the back of the car, I've spoken to somebody really, really interesting. Suddenly they're a lawyer or they're a doctor or they're an architect, and I wonder why they're driving an Uber. What are the challenges that they've got, and what are the things that you're doing that are kind of streamlining those?
Yeah, so if you, come from a different country, it doesn't matter what your sort of background is. Sometimes people have this kind of issues with language, which is a main barrier. But for many people, it's not language; it's just access to networks. Not having your skills or your qualifications or even experience recognized. So oftentimes you come from a different country, and migrants hear this all the time where we need local experience. And in some cases it makes sense. So you need to, for example, if you're an architect or a lawyer, you need to understand what kind of local, laws are. But still, architecture doesn't change, engineering doesn't change, medicine doesn't change, doesn't matter where you are in the world. So there's kind of these barriers that are systemic that stop people from getting involved. And then it costs a lot of money to kind of recertify, takes a lot of time.
Yep.
And then if you've got a family and, responsibilities, it's very hard to do that. So people oftentimes get stuck in these cycles of, you know, I'll just get make some money now, drive an Uber, working 7-Eleven or whatever kind of casual gigs just to make ends meet. And then you kind of, you know, if you're in it for too long, then you also have a huge gap in your career as well. And so harder to get in. So it's kind of the system is oftentimes, you know, stacked against people for that reason, that it's just hard to get in and get involved. And also there's no real pathways for people to get into employment. So if you're coming to a new country like Australia, you know, and you don't know anyone, when you want to, you know, get a job, the most that people will tell you is, you know, we'll help you improve your CV, or we'll help you with kind of English and things like that, which is fair and good as a starting point. But then that's not enough to be able to get a job. Mm. It's a tough enough job market as it is. But then if you're a migrant, it just makes it, you know, even harder to get that.
Okay. So I guess there are some organisations. So, you know, we mentioned earlier AIMS, the Australian Migrant Educational Service. What do they do versus what you're doing?
Yeah, so AIMS, there's other organisations like that who are really working on the education side and helping people, you know, I guess, understand how, you know, to find employment in Australia. There's still barriers that stop people from doing that, as I said, local experience. So, you can, there are organizations out there that are also helping people with internships mm-hmm. or kind of work experience pathways and placements that then help them get into their first gig. So there's some of those that exist as well, which is fantastic. Where I guess we are positioned is we are giving people an alternative pathway to employment and saying, you've got these amazing skills, why don't you look at starting your own business and really, you know, use that business to employ yourself, but also employ other people, create innovation, create impact, all that kind of stuff. I think the problem isn't in Australia isn't that it's hard to find a job. The problem is hard to find a meaningful job that's kind of relevant to your skill set or something that will kind of, you know, just get you excited and to get up in the morning sure. and to go to work. And so for many people, it's that. And that's a much tougher problem to deal with. Like unemployment is relatively easier to solve, but underemployment is an issue that we're particularly working with.
Okay. So what are the problems? Okay, here's what I'm imagining, and correct me, I'm sure I'm wrong. So I'm imagining that if somebody has a professional skill or you know, some sort of a technical skill, and they want to go out into the world and you know, hang up their shingle and start operating, some of the challenges might be, first of all, marketing, getting the word out. How are they going to get customers? They probably have some basic business skills. You know, do I incorporate a company? Is it a sole trader? Do I need insurance? You know, do I pay work cover? All that sort of stuff. And then I guess there are investment costs that's another issue. But I also wonder whether if somebody comes from a developing economy and they've got certain, cultural, religious, biases and I guess that maybe don't quite align with, you know, what we generally expect from people here, they might hit some problems. So I can imagine, you know, a female setting up a business wearing a hijab is going to have some challenges if she's, I don't know, whatever the business is that she... So is that the sort of, are they the sorts of challenges that you look at?
I would say yes and no, because, I mean, we've had people with Catalyzer from about 87 different countries, so it's a much wider net in terms of the people that I guess we've been able to support. The challenges that people are facing oftentimes are very simple and basic. So even before the kind of, you know, these cultural and other kind of religious challenges you're talking about, there are issues that we've seen, for example, in a lot of the world, you want to start a business, what do? You build a product or a service. You start selling it and you've got a business, right? Mm-hmm. In Australia, it's not that simple. You know, you need to register, you need to have, insurances, you need to make sure you're paying tax. And again, this sounds quite simple, but in many countries, people don't pay tax. People don't think about their business that way just because of the kind of, you know, where they're from and what's happening. And so it's really getting people to even understand, you know, what's the basics they need to kind of do to be able to cover themselves. So even registering a sole trader and just doing some of those basics is something that people don't know. And what that means is that, you know, for example, there are many people who are running a food business by just literally cooking food and selling it,
right.
Not knowing, you know, you need to have the food safety and all this kind of basic stuff, right? So there's some of those things that are out there. And then you've got all these other barriers, like cultural barriers, religious barriers, gender as well. And you talked about one of these things where it's less of a problem with like a woman in hijab trying to sell something. I mean, it depends on what it is. Mm. But I think it's more like how their family reacts to them kind of being in business. So we've seen that in the past where, and oftentimes, you know, if they're not being successful, if they're just doing it as a hobby, family's quite happy because they're like, okay, they're getting out of the house, they're doing something. But we've had these cases of people who, you know, sometimes their partners or their families will be like, no, you are too successful, and there's a bit of jealousy involved too.
Right.
So it's a...
Yeah, women can't be successful. I've got to bring in the most money.
Yeah,
even
yeah.
Even though so you're bringing in four
weird,
times as much.
It's a weird kind of thing, you're right. So, but obviously it's not in many cases. The other issues that we've seen is also sometimes with family violence as well. Mm-hmm. So there's that aspect, you know, that shows up. I mean, I guess like that happens with any kind of entrepreneurs, but because we are dealing with people from many different cultures, many different backgrounds, some of those inherent issues that, you know, that are happening in those areas also become highlighted when you're, you know, I guess trying to start a business because, you know, tensions run high, you know, there's financial issues, etc. So like, I guess we try to provide a wraparound support that helps people kind of like managing their well-being, connecting with other organizations that can support in different ways as well. And I guess the other thing that the biggest barrier that we've seen for people is like their cash flow. And so, you know, if you want to start a business, a startup, particularly in Australia, and you know, you've got some savings and so on, then, you know, you can say, okay, I can give myself this much runway and I can kind of get started and so on, or I've got family who can support me or friends. When you're a new migrant or refugee in a different country like Australia, you're starting from scratch. So you don't have something to fall back on. And what that means is that oftentimes people are working and also starting to start a business, and then that work could be any kind of work as well, so they're not kind of going all in, not this 100% kind of thing either. So it's just like working with those kind of different challenges and making sure that, you know, they're slowly building something, they're not looking at someone raising millions of dollars and saying, you know, this sure. is what we're trying to be, but actually creating a more sustainable business. And then some of them will be tech startups, some of them will be kind of social impact organizations and so on, but many of them end up being sort of more subsistence small business type organizations.
Yeah, okay. So how does Catalyzer work? So it's obviously not just you. How do you fund yourself, and what do you run courses? Is it one-on-one mentoring? How does that all work?
Great question. So we I'll just give you a bit of a history as well. So when we started, we were looking at kind of any kind of migrant or refugee entrepreneur. And so what that means, you know, we had small business, we had tech, anything. But we have evolved, I guess, over the last few years to specifically focus on tech startups and social impact.
Okay.
And the core reason is because we see that's the biggest, I guess, point of impact for us. And also we've got other organizations in the ecosystem who are supporting those small business type organizations who want to start a coffee shop or a food business, as an example. So there's one called SSI Ignite based in Sydney. There's one called Thrive Refugee Enterprise, which gives sort of microfinance and microloans and mentoring as well. So there's these organizations that are doing small business type of support. And then we focus more on the tech and the social impact. The programs we run, we've got two separate programs. We've got a fellowship program, which is really early stage. So you could be, you know, a migrant refugee who've just landed here and wants to learn about entrepreneurship, wants to start something. Could be anything, or you might not even have an idea. You can get involved. It's free. And you do that program, it's mostly online kind of masterclass and modules on different things. So lean startup, design thinking, you know, business modeling, finance, legal, all the kind of basic fundamentals you need. And then you also get connected with your community of peers within your city. So because of COVID, I guess that's kind of the benefit we've had. It's a national program now. So we've got presence in Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, Adelaide, like in person, and then other places as well, like people kind of meet up when they can. And so they can connect with people and do those community events and get mentoring as well. And through that kind of fellowship, that's kind of their way into the startup and social enterprise ecosystem in Australia. So that's, I guess, for most of the people, and we try to keep it as inclusive as possible and really kind of keep a low bar. Now, there are different, I guess, outcomes that happen through that program. So some people decide they want to start a startup and they've kind of validated their ideas and then they go further and we can help them further. Some people decide business or startup isn't for them, but use the networks and the kind of skills they've learned to get into a better job. Great. Some people use that as a pathway to find their co-founders. Some people use that as a pathway to go into other programs. So for us, all of those are sort of viable outcomes because we've set up as a not-for-profit to kind of support that. Mm-hmm. Then the second program we run, which is like our flagship program, is our Accelerate program. And so that's where we take in, you know, like, I guess the top, I guess, entrepreneurs and the sort of ideas and startups. They ideally should have an MVP, have a bit of a team around them, and then are looking to, you know, go get their early customers, look for growth, raise capital, all of that. Now, capital could be in terms of VC and angel, but also it could be sort of grants and other kind of types of funding as well, depending on what kind of model they're going after. So yeah, so that's the kind of two distinct programs. And in that kind of program, it's more focused on execution. So we've got entrepreneurs residents to help them. They end up kind of, you know, making a plan and hitting certain goals and milestones. And then they've got demo day where they pitch in front of a whole bunch of people.
Okay.
So that's quite similar to many other accelerator type programs. But the key, I think, thing that well, as president amongst both programs, is the community. So we've often been asked by people, you know, like, how are we different from, you know, the start mates of the world?
Yep.
And what we've seen is both in terms of the, I guess, participants, but also the mentors that are coming in. Many of them, both mentors come from migrant entrepreneurship backgrounds themselves, but also particularly the participants, they're all refugees and migrants themselves. And so it's that community that they can kind of see, you know, similar challenges they're facing, how they can help each other. So the program will end after a little while, but then they support each other. And we've seen that, you know, people who, for example, finished the program, you know, 5 years ago are now coming in and becoming EIRs or becoming in and sort of becoming mentors for the next generation and sort of passing on that knowledge. And so ideally we want to have see more of that, where we go to this future where, you know, it's a bit of a circular kind of thing happening. Mm-hmm. And once we see some more success, particularly for ventures, then even investment are coming in and supporting the early stage businesses as well.
Okay, so is it all online or is it?
So since COVID, mostly online, I'd probably say 80% online and 20% in person. Mm-hmm. And so what we're doing now and what we've learned is that people don't want to do everything in person. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of the feedback we've got. And so the workshops and the masterclasses that the people want is done online. The benefit is it's recorded. They can kind of play it back. They can, you know, translate it, all that kind of stuff. But with the community sessions, they're in person. So that's where people connect with each other, and it's more of that networking bit. So it's very hard to kind of do that online well. Mm-hmm. And so that's where, you know, people will meet in Sydney, for example, or Melbourne or other cities for events and so on. So that's something we're doing in person or demo day in person, but everything else is online.
Okay, so you coordinate that. So what was the journey? So this you were the founder?
Yeah, I am the co-founder.
So what was the journey in terms of spinning this up? Like, what was the entrepreneurial kind of challenges for yourself as an enterprise and as a not-for-profit? Do people pay or do you get government support, or how does that work?
Great question. So in terms of the journey, it was very kind of startup journey for ourselves as well. So I, you know, as I mentioned, I came here as a migrant myself from Pakistan. So back in 2013, I was an engineer in Australia, did a master's in engineering management, but then was, like many other people, you know, was working at 7-Eleven, BP, wasn't able to find meaningful employment. So I was quite frustrated by it and decided that I wanted to start my own business. And so I was looking around, trying to look at different opportunities, and saw this opportunity to be involved in a program run by School for Social Entrepreneurs, mm-hmm. which was an incubator for young people who had kind of social enterprise ideas. So I went in with a completely different idea, which is sort of a clean tech thing that failed, that didn't work. But through that process, I learned a lot and got some really good mentoring, mm-hmm. Sort of back in 2015, 2016, around how do you think about solving a problem and using entrepreneurship in startups. I also met my co-founder, who was a disillusioned, disenfranchised accountant who worked in one of the big four companies here.
So he was
from Western Sydney. He worked in accounting firms, decided that's not for him. Actually went to Bangladesh, learned microfinance and all that kind of work that's happening there, and then came back and wanted to do something meaningful. So we kind of connected on supporting this community of migrant refugees. He actually had connections with some of the local migrant resource centers who had people who were looking to start a business. So that was kind of like our first, I guess, place where we had pipeline. And then we rented a small space and started a program that way. The first program, we literally just cobbled together a pilot for 2 months, took 10 people in from different cultural backgrounds and had no idea if it's going to work. We were just doing a lot of cold calls for people and saying, hey, this person wants to start a food truck. Do you run a food truck? Can you help them or whatever? Yep. So very of that kind of like, you know, hustle resourceful mindset. But we, you know, even in that sort of early stage pilot when we had no idea what we were doing, the 10 people we had supported, out of those 10, 3 of them started a business, right? And so for me personally, that was a big kind of, confidence booster that, okay, you know, yeah, we don't know what we're doing and they're still kind of making it. And so many of these migrants, refugees just need a bit of a leg up. Mm. And so if we did it properly and learned how to do it, then that would really help. So then I spent the last 6-7 years really learning from the sort of startup ecosystem, getting amazing mentors involved who really kind of coached me but also helped sort of run the programs as well. And now we've been able to support lots of people through that kind of process. And every time we run a program, we get feedback, so we improve and iterate like other kind of founders do. Your question around funding and sustainability, it's always been a tough thing, as you know, like bootstrapping a startup is hard, but bootstrapping an incubator is like 10x hard. But for us, we, you know, we set up as a social enterprise. And so our initial thinking was, you know, maybe we'll find someone who can pay for it. Then pretty quickly pivoted to do a not-for-profit because we wanted to access those early stage grants. So we had some early stage funding from City of Parramatta Invest in Sydney, where we started. Then we have mostly been funded through corporate partners. Yep. So IAG was one of our big partners for a few years. Currently, our biggest partner is eBay Foundation from the US. And we've got some funding from Westpac, who's kind of supported us as well along the way. And so those are kind of our main partners that have, I guess, helped. And then we get, you know, we've had some government grants here and there, but that's not a consistent kind of stream of funding. We've also got a separate entity, which is Catalyzer Pty, our social enterprise arm. And so through that, we do consulting work with local governments, with universities, and some of that revenue also helps us kind of feed back into this.
Right.
So hopefully the long term for us is, you know, making that organization sustainable and then sort of paying the foundation so that it can become independent. We tried different business models in the beginning. So we tried charging people money, kind of doing a revenue share scheme, equity, all of that kind of fun stuff. Pretty quickly realized none of that's going to be an immediate revenue and enough revenue for us to kind of cover the bases. Mm. And also we were, I guess, putting people off in some ways because we were not giving out funding. So if you take equity in the early days, you're kind of hampering the startup's ability to actually go and raise capital.
Yep.
So now our program is completely free, but it's more to build that community and the expectation that, you know, yes, you're getting all these services for free, but then you kind of pay it forward in the future to other entrepreneurs that are coming after you.
Right. Okay. So we spoke a little bit earlier about some of the stuff that I was doing out in the South Pacific. So I'm interested in what the nexus is between those two worlds. So one of the companies, a company called Breadfruit Consulting, a guy called Chris Eplock, he was talking about certain programs that they were running, DFAT in Australia and MFAT in New Zealand, were running programs or paying these people to run programs within these developing economies. They were finding that some of the migrants that were coming over here, sorry, not migrants, seasonal workers that were coming over here, some of them would decide legally or illegally to stay. A lot of them were going back with pocketfuls of money, had seen the world here, and then either, had mishaps in terms of their ventures there or threw the money into just buying a van, driving people around, didn't do anything really innovative with it. And also there's the cultural thing. If you go back with, you know, full bags of money, you've got 5, 10, 20 grand, people expect you to give them money. So it doesn't really go into the economy to actually build value. So one of the things that we're talking about, and I'm interested in your, you know, I guess your view here, and potentially might be a thing for Catalyzer, where they were talking about programs in country. So instead of those seasonal workers leaving, doing something, you know, within that kind of space to understand how to set up a business and whatever, but actually taking those skills back. So given, that's what's rattling around in my head. Within that context, where do you think Catalyzer might have maybe an opportunity to expand in those sorts of things?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I mean, this is not an area that we've kind of done something specific in. The way we have currently expanded is we've done a pilot in New Zealand where we worked with a couple of foundations there to help them develop a program to support refugee entrepreneurs specifically in New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's something that's been running on for the last 3 years, and they're kind of doing an evaluation of the pilot at the moment, where we helped kind of hire some coaches and mentors, and then they brought in other organizations to do kind of content and microfinance and all sorts of different things. So that's been running there, and that's kind of one way we've got involved. I really like this kind of concept of training people in, especially those who want to then go back and kind of build something. We were both at the Global Entrepreneurship Congress, last week. And one of the things that we've been learning about is what's happening with Ukrainian refugees in Europe. And so I think there's kind of precedent for something like this and how this can work, where there's, you know, organizations in Europe that are doing this, that are training Ukrainian refugees with the mindset that these refugees are going to return back to their own country and one day, and those skills and experiences are going to be really valuable.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess this is the kind of same thing that, you know, we can think about doing here, where it could be a program specifically for some of those migrants or seasonal workers, and then getting them, you know, trained up in entrepreneurship kind of skills and experiences. We'll also build the networks with Australia, because, you know, if they go back and they start something, yes, the initial kind of pocket of money might be useful to get started, but that might not be enough to kind of help them sustain and grow. And so they still might need growth capital, which is an opportunity for some of these Australian funders. But then secondly, when they're looking to scale up, with many of these kind of smaller islands, they won't have enough of a market for most of the things. So then they, you know, and depending on the internet and other kind of situation, although you do have Starlink now, you can actually look at opportunities of creating a global business. And then that can employ lots of people locally. So, you know, you still need to be connected to kind of the community or organizations here in Australia, but also internationally. So I think that that network piece can be really, really important there, that they're not just networking amongst themselves, but also networking in the broader ecosystem, but then also learning the skills and the knowledge that they can go and apply. I think also having enough people around them who they can kind of trust and have this confidence that, you know, will pick them up when they fail, because most will eventually fail, as you know. Innovation and creativity is one of those things where it's lots of failure and then some success. But many of these cultures don't allow for a lot of failure, because you're kind of seen as high profile, everyone kind of supports you, and then if it doesn't work, everyone kind of turns their back against you. So it's also keeping that in mind of like, how do you have the safe space of knowing enough people who will support you, and what's the right time to then sort of you know, basically get a microphone and sort of shout from the rooftops. It might not be at that early stage, but how do you kind of create that? So I think it's a fantastic idea and something worth exploring.
Yeah. So some of the things that I saw that I think are going to be challenges to solve. So one of them is, you know, Vanuatu, and I believe some of the other regions in that area have got, there's this, what they refer to as the big man kind of culture. So, you know, you come back with 20 grand, you buy a van, and you're now the big man. And so they like that status symbol piece. So I think what you're saying is right, you know, so the idea of them failing at anything would actually be really, really, you know, scary monsters for them, because it might diminish them within the eyes of the community. The other thing that some challenges that they would have, so you mentioned Starlink, and I think that's right on the money. The problem is that, you know, governments will enact legislation and they will say, well, Starlink comes here, they've got to do a partnership with Vodafone and Unicell and whatever, even though Starlink doesn't need to enter the network there. They just, you know, all they need is FedEx to land, switch it on, plug it in, and away you go, you know. So I think there's some challenges there. But also the other challenge is banking. So people not trusting their banks, and also there's a level of corruption there that, you know, I mean, I'm not saying there's no corruption here, but certainly from a setting up a business and getting going point of view, we don't really have any problems within this country. So I think there's some serious challenges there. But I think that certainly that conversation, now I think the flywheel is starting to spin now to get some people those skills and being able to go off and do things. Okay, so why don't we sort of move on from there? So you came to Australia. Let's go back a little bit about kind of your journey into the country, maybe. And obviously, you've got this entrepreneurial spirit, and you know, you wonder how many people are stepping off boats and planes who've got that in their DNA. Poor things. So what was the journey like for you coming across?
Yeah. So I mean, initially came, as I said, in 2013, and my my background, I'm from Pakistan. As I said, I'm an engineer and so studied there. But then the other thing, I've always been an internal migrant in Pakistan. So my dad was a doctor, but he was in the army. And so what that meant was that every couple of years, we would sort of pick up, you know, pack our bags, go to a different city. So lived all across the country when I was sort of growing up. And I think that gave me the ability to connect with different people, understand different cultures, and what's happening, and kind of make new friends and so on. So for me, this was kind of like, it made sense. I initially came here to do a master's in engineering management, and then, you know, kind of had, like, you know, come from a minority community that was kind of persecuted, so decided to, you know, take asylum here, stay as a refugee, which is another kind of long story. But I initially didn't come with a plan to stay in Australia. It was more for education and particularly to do a master's. The kind of decided to stay here. But like, to your point around how many people come here who have this kind of entrepreneurial DNA, I think generally if you're a migrant refugee, no matter what kind of background you're coming from, in many of those cases, you're taking a huge initiative. You're moving to a different country. Sure. And it's not just people coming to Australia, but like, you know, even Australians coming to the UK or US or whatever, you will see that, you know, they're going in because they've got a bit of drive or motivation or initiative to do something. And so even from like a general population, you are the kind of people who would kind of take initiative, have a bit more resilience, are kind of used to or at least handle some uncertainty, which are quite similar characteristics and traits you see in entrepreneurs, right?
Sure.
Who are within the kind of general population are probably the kind of people who will a bit more risk kind of takers, looking at, you know, dealing with uncertainty, have a bit more resilience, like kind of dealing with rejection and setbacks and so on. But I think the other thing that for my personal journey, and I think this is something that I've seen with many different migrants is spotting opportunities where, you know, when you come to a new country or a new system, everything is a blank slate and you can ask a question and try to understand why certain things work the way they do. So you don't take things for granted and you go, okay, well, why is this way? Why can't it be done that way? Or you might have an idea or might have seen something in another part of the world that might apply here. And so also like trying to bring those things, whether that's something simple as food or something more complex, you know, from an engineering perspective or whatever. Mm. And so, yeah, I think there's like when you're a migrant, there's all these kind of things that are coming in and it's this sort of idea of migrant entrepreneurship isn't something that we've started at Catalyzer. No. We've just kind of tried to amplify it. But even when we started, we looked at the data in collaboration with IAG. So they found, this is back in 2017, 2018, where one third of Australian small businesses were run by first generation migrants,
right?
Which when you think about it, that's huge.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And out of those, sort of business owners, 83% of them did not have a business in their home country.
Right.
So, that sort of tells you that, you know, that people are starting businesses here for the first time. And most often that's because of need, but also because of opportunities that they're spotting. And we see the same thing with tech startups. We're waiting for the, I guess, new survey results for Startup Muster. But the last one back in 2019 found that 36% of Australian startup founders came from a migrant background, right? Which is huge. Because, I mean, yes, we are a country with a lot of migrants. But when you look at it, you know, about one-fourth, about 26, 27% of us are kind of born overseas. But the representation of entrepreneurship is much higher. And then representation in unicorns is even higher. So that's the other thing where it's not just the small business. It also goes all the way to tech impact, unicorns, everything. And so I think personally part of that is just because of the traits, the resilience, the initiative, the motivation, the wanting to do something for your family or for yourself, that, you know, you kind of have that drive.
I think it's an important space. I mean, I'm the son of an entrepreneur. Not my dad, it was my mum. My mum started clothing businesses back in the 80s and the early 90s, and she was the, you know, I guess they're a really resilient one, whereas Dad was sort of more, you know, he drove cars, he worked in a factory, but she was the one. So do you see much in the way of female entrepreneurs?
Yeah, so out of the 900 plus people that we've supported so far, 46% have been women.
Right.
So, like almost half,
yep.
Which is, I mean, part of this was us kind of trying to specifically make sure that, you know, we had the diversity as well. So some of our mentors, or EIRs, also, you know, wanted to make sure there were women, ideally women migrant entrepreneurs, because they understood that specific kind of journey or the kind of challenges that they face, and then they attract others like them. And oftentimes women are more entrepreneurial, especially those who've come in on, say, something like a partner visa, because then, you know, they might be here, they might have a family or might not have kind of a big family, but then might have time on their hands to do stuff. And so there's lots of opportunities that women get involved in. And then we've also had some really highly skilled women come here as well, had the same kind of issues with, you know, starting a family and then kind of, you know, feeling stuck because not being able to kind of enter the job market. Mm. And so they see entrepreneurship as an alternative pathway into kind of creating something. So we're definitely seeing there's a lot of women that are getting involved here in Australia, but also globally. I mean, you know, same thing with like Ukrainian refugees in the Europe. This is one of the things that's happening with many of the refugees there are women. And then they're also kind of, you know, learning about entrepreneurship and starting businesses. So
the boys are fighting the war. They started the business.
Yeah. But I think it's a part of this is also, I think it's just like the kind of business that now we can do, particularly digital and tech, that many of the businesses can be done with from home with a bit more flexibility, particularly post-COVID. And so that's also meant that it's a lot more flexible and you don't have to be in the office or you don't have to do the hard industries. And so we're seeing a lot more of that kind of gender gap being filled as well.
Yeah. Look, a question occurred to me. So from the entrepreneurs, the migrant entrepreneurs here, How do they normally raise their first sort of seed capital? Is it savings? Is it, are they going to the community? Are they kind of, you know, sometimes you have, some people have systems, you know, where they sort of pool their funds and support a particular individual. What are they doing?
Look, it's all of the above. You know, some people would have kind of family who will support them, but in many cases, that's not the case. So they would oftentimes, you know, go with their savings, or they would want, they would kind of hold a part-time job or sometimes in a full-time job and kind of just
keep,
pay, keep driving the Uber,
yeah,
whatever else that they have to do, right? Or cut down expenses, all that kind of stuff, or a partner's working and then one person's kind of doing. So all these kind of models. But often it's very hard to raise that early capital for people generally in Australia, because we know investors here are very risk averse compared to, for example, countries like the US, but, and especially in current market. But when it comes to migrant entrepreneurs, it's even harder, especially if you're not doing a tech kind of business. Mm-hmm. So many of them don't actually want to raise kind of VC funding either. Some of them do, who are kind of focused in that, but many of them don't, because they either focus on social impact or they focus on like a lifestyle type business where they want to set up a decent business that can support them, and they are happy bootstrapping. And so this is a kind of other mindset where, you know, like you would think that many would want to go and raise capital, but many are saying, look, we're happy with a small business, we're happy to kind of generate revenue even if it's in tech. You know, we've got a business called HR Partner that has about 1500 businesses that are HR SaaS platform. So we've got 1500 clients over 70 different countries. They've bootstrapped it all the way,
right?
So they've not raised a single dollar of capital.
Wow.
Just because they wanted to have that kind of independence, and they wanted to just make it a decent kind of mid-sized business.
Yep.
And we've seen that happen across, you know, kind of different businesses as well. So yeah, there's no one size fits all. The people who do want to raise, I mean, obviously do face barriers to kind of raising capital, which is one of the reasons why we've set up a new fund to invest in that pre-seed stage with migrant entrepreneurs.
Fantastic. Okay, well, that's probably a good place to stop. But before we finish, why don't you tell everyone, if they're interested in getting in touch with Catalyzer and any of your programs, how they get in touch with you?
Yeah, so you can go to catalyzer.com.au, ecatalyser.com.au, and you'll find all our programs there, and you can get in touch. If you want to write to us, you can also just do hello@catalyzer.com.au, and we'll get back to you on, you know, whatever your, I guess, query is. Yeah, if you want to connect with me, very happy to do that on LinkedIn. I kind of, you know, I'm always looking for migrant entrepreneurs, investors, anyone who's interested in supporting this ecosystem to connect with as well, because I don't believe that I can do it alone or we can do it alone. We do it as a collective, and so different organizations that we partner with as well. So if anyone's interested, very happy to connect.
Awesome. Thank you, mate. I think what you're doing is really, really important. Good luck on it. And hopefully, if this thing keeps flying, we'll have you back in a year or so and see how things are going.
Thank you so much. Thanks a lot for having me.
Okay. Thanks, mate. Okay. So I hope you enjoyed my interview with Usman. I am very grateful for him catching up with us and doing the podcast. I think Usman's work in entrepreneurship for immigrants and for refugees is really important. And I also think that it dovetails a little bit into the world of the developing economies, which is an area I'd like to explore further. But I think he's an amazing guy, and I think he is a credit to not only himself, but also to our country and how supportive we are of this type of activity. So until next time, feel free to reach out to us at hello@entrepreneurship.au if you think you've got a story to tell or some part of the entrepreneurial landscape that you want to talk about. Until next time. Today's podcast is brought to you by FinHawk, your digital risk advisors. If safeguarding the digital aspect of your business is important to you, you need a solid plan for cybersecurity and compliance, and that's where FinHawk comes in. With FinHawk's front-loading communications and regulatory compliance service, you're not just reacting to crises, you're ahead of them. This service gives you a ready-to-go playbook for dealing with data breaches and compliance issues before they happen. So don't wait for a crisis. Get proactive with FinHawk. To learn more, click the link in the show notes or email hello@finhawk.com.au or go to the website finhawk.com.au. Your future self will thank you.